From GEICO Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts, broadcasting from your brain. You think you live in a pretty safe place, but you just heard about a break-in 4 miles away, which isn't close, but it isn't far either, you know? Art Palpitations is on the scene.
I sure am, Tammy, and I don't even know why I drove out here, because as you know, you got customized renter's insurance through GEICO, so your stuff is covered.
Oh, well, that's great. Any sign of crime there, Art?
Just some light littering, Tammy, but like they say, a little litter can lead to a lot.
Wise words. It feels good to worry less. It feels good to GEICO.
Coming up on AI Haven't a Clue.
They can pump out robots all day long that are quite capable and less than $10,000 a piece.
We're talking about AI misconceptions.
To go to DeepMind, where one of their five core values is kindness. The buzz in Silicon Valley is completely different than anywhere else in the world.
How it's reshaping our lives.
It becomes viable to put data centers in space, which sounds amazingly crazy.
And we're getting into agents.
You're not taking full advantage of AI.
Hello, welcome. This is AI Having a Clue with KPMG. I am proud AI novice, George Butler.
A proud novice, interesting. I am a proud AI expert, James Chandler.
And I was trying to make the point that, like, I'm proud not to be an expert in, you know, knee deep in AI. Yeah. It didn't come out quite right, though, did it?
Yeah, I don't feel like much of an expert sometimes. Sort of just coping with it.
I know what you mean.
Just plug it into the back of your head, you know, download it all, and then sort of away you go, yeah.
So it's a bit like Severance.
A bit like that.
Like, when you come into the studio, you're an expert. When you leave, you're just God, Jimmy.
You drain me.
Funnily enough, you're not the first person to say that. On the way today, we are chatting to a super fascinating guest. He's an AI futurist, an entrepreneur. He's worked at Google's DeepMind, Intel. I mean, he is a proper experienced tech legend. Steve Brown, coming up on the show. Google DeepMind, I feel like that's something we've never really talked about on the show before.
And we should.
What is DeepMind?
Sort of see it as Google's AI lab. So any sort of AI system they could build, probably stuff around language, probably stuff around maps. You know, it's sort of like an AI potion that you could pour on all the brilliance that Google do already. But and like an amazing UK success story.
It's really interesting as well. I mean, we should definitely talk to Steve Brown about, clearly we've got fantastic roots in the UK with, you know, tech and entrepreneurship, and how we can continue to foster that. And, you know, if it is flourishing, or perhaps if it's falling behind. That's all in the way with Steve. First though, James, should we do a listener question?
Yes, please. Yeah, I'd like that.
Let's do today's AI question with KPMG. Now, as you well know, anyone that asks a listener question, they win themselves this.
You get an AI.
Yes, a very fantastically fitting, high quality, quite stylish t-shirt is coming David's way in Liverpool. Ooh. Hi, David.
Booch.
I feel like everyone in Liverpool's turned.
Booch, looch in a booch.
I apologise to anyone from Liverpool that is listening. Today's AI question with KPMG is from David in Liverpool, who says, would you rather have a human doctor with 20 years experience or an AI-trained doctor on every medical paper ever written?
Goodness me.
Wow, that's a deep, deep question. Because one of the things that comes up time and time again when we talk about AI, and we're looking at the pros and the cons, people always say, yeah, there are dangers, we talked about the dangers. But then, you know, there's brilliant things that will be done in medicine and healthcare. So it's actually a really interesting question.
Healthcare has come up a lot, hasn't it, actually, in some of the guests we talked to. My knee-jerk goes, I think probably the AI, but the more I sort of think about it, maybe the doctor wouldn't be a bad idea. The thing you've got to remember about what doctors do is, sort of medicine and everything around it isn't just about sort of knowledge and retaining knowledge. You can upload all of the knowledge to ChatGPT and it can learn it and spit it back at you, but it's not just about memorizing it. There is empathy, you know, judgment, wisdom, you know, stuff that is going to be really hard for AI to do. So even if it's got all the data and it could look at something, it still might not get it right. And I think, you know, doctors have on a daily basis very difficult conversations with people, symptoms that maybe aren't clear. Like, how would you talk to someone who couldn't give you any information because they were in a coma or they were mute or something like that? So doctors have this sort of innate skill set that maybe AI doesn't, which would sort of lead me towards a human doctor with 20 years. That said, of course, humans get tired, they get overloaded.
Especially in an overburdened health system.
Of course, they get occasionally get things wrong. And, you know, AI doesn't have any of those issues. It can process unbelievable amounts of data in a very short time. It can make sort of quick decisions. It can look at whole heaps of data. It can find patterns. So I think there's probably no doubt that AI probably already can outperform humans. I mean, I've seen experiments where levels of accuracy versus human surgeons is as good, if not better. And it's happening remotely as well. So I don't think we can get to a place where AI is replacing doctors entirely. So I hope I wouldn't have to pick between the two. My politician's answer, I think if you really forced me to do it, I think I probably would still pick the human today. That might sort of change in time. But I think just because of all those slightly unwritten, perhaps undervalued skills that AI can't do, which are very human things, particularly around quite sensitive things or tough conversations or things like that, I think I'd rather have the doctor of 20 years at the moment.
Of course, I agree.
What about you?
No, I totally agree with you. I think firstly, it's going to take a long time also for people to kind of accept having that intimacy with a bot. We've seen it with a lot of technologies, especially where sort of maybe slightly older generations, they don't want to just dive in with technology, and they take their time a little bit more. So, but I think on the flip side, as you made the very valid point that our doctors are overburdened at the moment, but I can see how like real brilliant human doctors will be able to kind of have their workload eased slightly by AI tools.
Yeah, I think as ever, I think the combination of human brilliance, sort of enhanced and backed up by AI, I think it's a pretty good combination. It's sort of hard to see beyond that. And that's doctors, that's podcast creation, whatever you want to think. I think the combination of those two things, I think for me at the moment, I think is probably the way forward rather than it being kind of a very binary one or the other.
David, thank you for that question. Your T-shirt is...
Luch in your
Stop him. We will be back after this with Steve Brown. Right, so now on AI Haven't a Clue, we are going to be joined by someone who's got a really impressive, incredible CV from Silicon Valley to the heart of British innovation, AI futurist, entrepreneur and author Steve Brown is going to join us on the show now. Steve's worked at the forefront of AI and emerging technology for more than 25 years.
He's had senior roles at Google's DeepMind during the launch of AlphaFold and as chief evangelist at Intel.
Good title, that.
He now advises major global brands on how to become truly AI-first organizations, not just adopting AI tools, but fundamentally redesigning how the work gets done. Let's hear from Steve.
Steve, hello, and thank you so much for joining us on AI Haven't a Clue. We were chatting at the start of the show just about your incredible... career, your incredible CV. I mean, you have worked at some amazing places. So I guess before we go any further, could you just tell us a little bit about kind of the experiences that you've had in your working life and kind of how you've ended up where you are now as an AI futurist?
Sure. So started my career in England, hence my outrageous British accent, but I now live on the, the west coast of the US. I've been here for almost 30 years now. Began with Intel as an engineer. So when Intel was, one of the most important companies in the world, helping them to build custom systems. But I quickly tired of engineering and gone onto the dark side of business and joined marketing and rose to be one of Intel's two futurists. So I worked in Intel's labs, helping to figure out what's the future going to be like and what's the role that Intel has in that. Did that for a little time. And then it became clear to me that Intel did not have a great future. Leaders were not making the right decisions. And so I parted company and went out on my own, set up my own business, also set up a couple of startups. So co-founded some startups along the way. And then more recently, I got to come back to London and recharge my British accent and work for Google DeepMind. So I did an assignment for them for about 18 months and had the time of my life in King's Cross working with some of the smartest AI minds on the planet. So I've had a very varied career. Now I help Fortune 500 companies around the world understand AI, what it means for them, and how do they build an AI-first organization so that they can, well, I was going to say be successful, but realistically, still be around 5 years from now. That's kind of what it comes down to.
Take us back to that time at Intel where you were a futurist and you were sort of looking at that near, that far future. What sort of futures were you talking about back then?
This is 2015, 2016 timeframe. We were able to look out 10 or 15 years, and that was the timeframe that we were looking at. And so I helped them wrap up the 2025, 2026 business plan when I was there. And there were a few of us who were saying it's really about what at the time we were calling cognitive computing, which was before people were really saying AI. And the vision we had back then that that intelligence would be embedded into objects. You know, Intel was a very, and still is in some ways, a very PC-centric organization. And so they always saw the world through the lens of that. And they were looking at embedding intelligence in things. And they really weren't seeing what actually happened, which is the intelligence went into the cloud. So that was what people were thinking about, was intelligent devices everywhere that would coordinate. And there was a kind of this vision of ambient computing where, you know, the world would just be smart and responsive to your needs.
We were talking about DeepMind at the start of the show and how it's effectively the brains of Google and it's and where Google's going next. What was it like working there? What were you up to?
An amazing organization run by incredible people. Sir Demis Hassabis is a national treasure. He's one of the global minds in AI, highly respected. I have nothing but admiration for him and what he's achieved. And getting to work for him was just incredible. Actually, my direct line boss was Laila Ibrahim, who was the chief operating officer at the time, also an amazing human being, trying to make sure that AI is deployed responsibly in the world. Just working there, it's very chill. And yet there's so much as hive of activity to try and, you know, bring AGI to the world. And just inspiring to be there. It was a bit of an adjustment for me, actually, because at Intel, it was very dog-eat-dog, and you have to have sharp elbows, and, you know, my elbows perhaps weren't sharp enough when I was there. I don't really like that. But to go to DeepMind, where one of their five core values is kindness. You know, it's a really lovely collaborative environment. And the number of people that would lean over and say, hey, can I help you with that? And they weren't going to get anything out of it. They just wanted to help you. So it has a lovely culture, and they are probably the most important company in the UK right now.
Yeah.
Why, Steve? I mean, some might think it's an obvious question, this, but why are they the most important company in the UK right now?
If you think about what's the future of industry going to be about, and potentially what's the future for the United Kingdom. You know, I still hold a British passport and I'm still cheering from 5,000 miles away for Britain's success. But it's going to need to found itself on new industries, and the new industries are what DeepMind is all about. You know, using AI to accelerate drug discovery, using AI for robotics. And so I would love to see the UK orient themselves much more around that than they are today.
We've talked a lot in this show about there was much fanfare, I think, where we were getting slightly cozier with the US, and it felt like the right thing to do. I remember the sort of pomp and ceremony around President Trump coming, and he brought a lot of those tech leaders with him, which was kind of an interesting choice. We made some deals. We kind of the relationship has sort of chilled a little bit since then. And then there's lots of talk around, around Britain's place. You know, should we be looking more to China? What's kind of going on in Europe, or do we put all our eggs in the kind of the US basket? What's your take on the role that Britain can play? Should we try and go it alone? Is there such thing as kind of sovereign AI, or should we be looking to make some smart partnerships around the world?
there is such a thing as sovereign AI, and every country should invest in that. But in addition to that, yeah, you need to make smart partnerships. The US is currently leading in terms of the best models in the world. China is 3 to 6 to 9 months behind, depending on who you ask and how you're comparing apples to apples. But they are doing very well in robotics. The US is advanced in the brains of the best robots. They have the smartest robots that can do, you know, really intelligent things. But China's got a really impressive manufacturing supply chain, and they can pump out robots, you know, all day long that are quite capable and less than $10,000 a piece. So yeah, I think the UK's, I'm an AI guy, right? I have my own opinions on politics. I pay close attention. I have to, as part of what I do. But I think broad alliances with the US and China are probably smart for the UK.
On robotics, have you seen the demo of the, it's almost like an Amazon warehouse type robot, stood there for 11 plus hours, just sorting out packages, not a single error in 11 hours. You know, it just seems like such an obvious thing.
It did make some mistakes. You're talking about the figure robot.
Right.
They put it, yeah, yes. They actually gave up after 200 hours. They originally wanted to see, could it do an 8-hour shift? And they let it run for 9 days and said, okay, 200 hours, let's call it done.
Wow.
And they put it up against one of the best human. I mean, all it was doing was taking packages as they came off a line and orientating them so that the barcode was down so it could be read on a scanner as it went over a conveyor belt, which is mind-numbing work. But robot doesn't care. They had a human up against that robot, and the human marginally beat it, like, by fractions of a second.
Come on! Yeah, so come on, the humans! The edge.
But does a human really want to do that? No, thank you.
Yeah. And for 200 hours. I mean, you know, you're going to need to take... Yeah.
Tell us about the sunny west coast of America, where you are, because obviously it's home to many of the biggest businesses and the leading minds when it comes to artificial intelligence. What's it like working out over? Obviously, you've got Silicon Valley over there, and California is a hub for tech in general. What's it like being out there, and is it different on the West Coast from that point of view than it is to maybe in London or anywhere else, really?
Yeah, and I'm not in the heart of Silicon Valley. I'm actually in the Silicon Forest up in Oregon. So I'm in the state north of California, but I venture down there quite a lot. I have a lot of friends down there. I spend a lot of time down there when I was working at Intel. The buzz in Silicon Valley is completely different than anywhere else in the world. The energy there, I mean, if you want to, you just go to any coffee shop and you will hear people talking about AI. You will overhear them all over the place. And it's just, that's what everybody's focused on. The people who are there live and breathe it. And that's where all these startups are growing up. And the UK needs to have that same kind of startup excitement. You know, some of it is that there's just not the capital investment infrastructure there to put money into startups in the UK like there is in North America.
We were we're covering a story in the last couple of weeks. You know, potentially we get to the end of 2026. We've got $2 trillion companies in SpaceX, possibly OpenAI. And it feels like as if Sam Altman and Elon Musk can fight over anything else. It's who's going to have the first $1 trillion company. What's your sort of analytical take on both of those companies? Who's likely to get there first? Who's going to succeed in the long term? Two very different companies, by the way.
It's three companies I'm keeping my eye on. So SpaceX, of course, I can tell you why I think that's an interesting bet. OpenAI and Anthropic. Anthropic is the other one to watch. They're already valued at $900 billion, so they're grazing that $1 trillion valuation. I think if and when they go public, which is likely in 2027, they will easily become a $1 trillion and then multi-trillion dollar company. Wow. OpenAI, probably the same. They're floundering a bit lately. But hopefully they'll right the ship.
Why so, Steve? Why do you think they are floundering a little bit?
Some of it is they didn't focus in the right place to begin with. And this has been broadly talked about, but Anthropic really focused on code generation and enterprise, so serving the needs of businesses, when ChatGPT was really a consumer-grade product. you know, focusing on making images. And then they had that little dalliance with Sora making videos for people and trying to get into the, you know, there's a few things they've done that just weren't the right thing. So hopefully they're righting that ship and really refocusing on enterprise. Their revenue is actually higher than Anthropic's this month. So, you know, they're on their way back. It's switched to SpaceX. We're getting to the point where there's a lot of NIMBYism when it comes to data centers. People don't want a data center in their backyard, not necessarily for rational reasons, but mostly because we don't want our electric bills to go up. If we could solve that issue, there's no real reason not to have a data center near you. It doesn't use that much water. So anyway,
yeah.
But it's happening. So also permitting and the cost of building a data center is pretty high. If you can collapse the cost of putting a payload into space, which SpaceX does with their Starship platform, and that's probably dropping the cost of putting a kilogram into space by 99%, that means that it becomes viable to put data centers in space, which sounds amazingly crazy, but it's likely to happen just because it, in some ways it's going to become easier to put data centers in space. They're already up near the communication satellites, so you can communicate with lasers, and it, you know, it's pretty amazing what you can do. And so the next hyperscaler, the next, you know, Amazon Web Services, Azure, Google Cloud, could well be SpaceX. They could be the next provider of AI in space.
James, you love hyping up AI, don't you?
Well, I'm glass half full about it, yeah.
That glass is overspilling.
Well, you could say I'm just embracing the future.
Half full. Half full? That glass is overspilling.
It's called embracing the future, my friend.
And yes, it obviously is important to do so, and that is what this show is all about. But things are just moving so quickly, it's hard not to question whether there's a disconnect between the tech advancements and what's actually happening in businesses and boardrooms.
I think AI over the last year has moved from probably what used to be a nice to have to a strategic necessity, if you wanted a posh term for it. And you know, we're seeing that for ourselves, even in the news that we cover on a weekly basis. And with that necessity, I think comes this huge pressure to keep up with AI. According to KPMG's latest AI Pulse, 70% of UK business leaders say AI will remain a top priority, with most ready to keep investing even before the ROI is fully proven.
But we often discuss on the show how a lot of AI initiatives struggle to take off or just implemented poorly, especially when it comes to trust, governance, or just getting the workplace ready to actually use AI.
But that's where KPMG come in. They're not just looking at the tech. They're actually helping organisations make the difference by turning AI ambition into a transformation you can actually trust. They focus on scaling with confidence, embedding governance from day one, and getting what everyone loves, measurable value.
And if you are ready to move beyond the pilot phase,
visit kpmg.com/UK to learn more. That's kpmg.com/UK.
Steve, you mentioned you're working with some of the biggest businesses across the world. What are you finding people are getting, well, businesses are getting right about AI, and equally, what are they getting wrong?
I think leaders really face a tough choice at the moment. And I spend a lot of time talking with leadership teams, with boards, and one of the first things I tell them is you have to make a choice. You can continue with what I call 20th century thinking, or you can embrace 21st century thinking. Let me explain what I mean. For the last 50 or 60 years of information technology, you know, the IT department has brought a new technology and leaders say, okay, great. How can we use this to cut costs? How can we do more with less? And what that really means is fewer people. And so that it could be the way that leaders approach AI, but it is a very different technology than any of the previous stuff that's come out of the IT department. You could if you have a short-term view and an incremental growth view, you could use AI to do labor substitution, right? Just get rid of a few people and increase your margins and yay, go us. Maybe you grow your business 10% or 20% and you know you slap yourself on the back and think, haven't we done well? No, you haven't. The reason is because if you take the 21st century approach and you think differently and you say AI is something I can use as an amplification, I can amplify the people that I already have and I can use that to create more value. And that potentially, instead of growing your business 10%, you're now growing it 10x. So that's the mistake people are making, is they're going down that old path. The first thing a leader, because it's what they've learned to do for maybe 30 years, right, is how do I use IT to cut costs? If you do that, you're not taking full advantage of AI. And what you're potentially doing is putting your business at risk, because when your competitor goes the other path, by amplifying the value you're creating and amplifying your scale, you get economies of scale and you collapse costs that way. You make all of your competitors who followed the old route irrelevant. And so that's the thing I spend most time explaining to people, is how do you become an AI first company? How do you fully harness AI so that you're still around 5 years from now? If you follow the old path, you may be gone.
From a generation point of view as well, Steve, you know, people in leadership roles, senior roles, you know, are older, maybe less averse to change, technology. There's all that kind of thing that comes with it. Meanwhile, you've probably got a workforce who are digital native, possibly AI native, coming into the workforce now. Are you finding this sort of disconnect within businesses as well? And there's almost sort of fear, perhaps, with exec teams and leadership teams?
To some extent, a lot of the leaders I work with, I mean, they're hiring me because they're oriented towards being successful and doing something with AI. But there is a little bit of that. I tell them a story about a guy I used to work with at Intel, a lovely man, Scotsman. And it was the era when we just first got email for the first time. I'm aging myself here. We got email at Intel and he refused to use it. He refused to use it. And he would have his admin print out all of his emails. He would handwrite a response on them, hand them back to her, and have her type them up. And now you can imagine how impactful he was and what his productivity was like. And eventually he gave into it. He learned to, you know, peck away at a keyboard with two fingers. And he learned to type and eventually got into it and did email. But, you know,
it's quite ironic that he worked in a computing, you know.
I know, exactly. Don't let that happen to you with AI. You can't afford to have that delay.
AI agents is an interesting area. We've talked about them a fair bit on the show before. And
yeah.
The way my simple brain can kind of comprehend what they are is that it's like everyone's going to have their own AI personal assistant speaking to other people's and other businesses' personal assistants. I mean, that's probably quite a simple way of putting it, but where are we with AI agents? How close are we to them becoming a real part of the masses' everyday lives? Because we're not there yet, and it feels like I don't think people are probably quite ready for it. But is that where we're headed? And, you know, with your futurist hat on, how quickly might we get there if it is?
I think you'll start to see, I mean, you've already seen the first, let's call it consumer grade agent. Last week, Google I.O., they announced an agent for consumers for the first time. But the big ones that people talk about, which is Hermes agent and OpenClaw, they're not ready for prime time yet. They're still, you know, for nerds who want to use them, but they are very, very impressive. You should change the framing, the way you think about AI, from being a tool. Once it becomes an agent, it becomes more like a digital employee or a digital assistant or a digital coworker. And that's the way it's going to feel in the workplace. Your work colleagues will be a combination of humans and machines. And the companies that figure out how to orchestrate the humans and the machines and have them work most effectively together are the ones that are going to be the most successful in 2027 and 2028. So it's a new emerging technology, but people need to be engaging in it right away.
But on a practical sense, Steve, I mean, the news cycle around AI is pretty dizzying. It's sort of frenetic. I mean, you could just absorb it. How do you take it all in? How do you stay across everything?
I mean, I spend probably 3 hours a day just researching. I have to. I'm reading, I'm listening to podcasts, whenever I exercise.
Oh, any good ones?
Well, yours comes to mind. Yours is a pretty decent one, but yeah.
Sorry, Steve.
Yeah, I spend about 3 hours a day, and then I have people in the industry that I stay connected to and have conversation with. But that's the value I bring to clients. Is I am fully anchored in what is happening. I can tell you what happened yesterday and the week before, and what it all means. That's my goal. If I have a superpower, I've been told this. It is that I can take complex technical information and make it understandable by normal people. And that's what I try and do for my clients.
I imagine, Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not the easiest time to be a futurist right now. I mean, are seeing, obviously, things change literally day by day, week by week, and it's quite difficult to look too far ahead into the future, but clearly that's part of your job, and businesses are wanting you to look ahead and predict trends and see what's happening in 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years. How hard of a job is that right now?
Extremely. I mean, when I was at Intel, we were looking out 10 or 15 years. I think that's impossible now. I think realistically, you can only see 2 to 3 with any kind of clarity. You can think about the grand arcs of change, sort of big picture stuff in the next 10, 15, maybe 20 years, but not with any kind of specificity or high confidence, because it's very unclear how things are going to play out. And there, it is in some ways kind of a chaotic system. And a good futurist, FYI, doesn't predict the future. That's a fortune teller. it's not like I go into a darkened room and smoke peyote and think big thoughts. What you're trying to do is stay on top of trends and look and figure out how will those trends play out over time, and then how will different trends collide, whether that be a technology trend and a business trend, or a technology trend and a consumer usage trend. That's what you're trying to do. And it's trying to ask and answer two questions. What's the world that we want to build? And what's the world that we want to avoid? That's the real job of a futurist.
So I'm gonna get you to get that crystal ball out. But in order to look 2 or 3 years ahead, so if you had to pick kind of one really important trend for individuals and one really important trend for businesses over the next 2 to 3 years, something that you think is going to cause quite a seismic change to the way that we live, the way we operate, what would you go with?
For businesses, I think agentic AI is it. Figuring out how to re-engineer workflows in the workplace and figure out how do agents work in partnership with humans, and how do you use agents not just to offload tasks from humans, and there'll be some of that because you're taking the suck out of people's jobs, right? You're taking offload the tasks that people find boring and repetitive. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
But what you really want to do, and this is a big trend I see, is how do you pair people with agents to amplify the impact that that person has? And it's not just about productivity. Productivity is one vector of performance. It could be amplifying their creativity. It could be improving the quality of their output. It could be giving them greater intuition, helping them make higher quality decisions. So that's what I see as going to be a big trend in business, is figuring out how to use agents strategically to amplify the impact of the talent that you already have. So that's the business side of things. On the consumer side of things, I'm expecting a lot more pushback against AI.
We're starting to see it, aren't we? We're starting to see it right now. With just the other day, we were talking about graduation ceremonies. I'm sure you saw those videos of the young people booing. So we're starting to see it, aren't we?
Yeah, and I think that's going to continue, especially if we see some job losses, which at the moment leaders are chalking up to AI because it's easier and they get rewarded when it comes to the to the street, versus saying, hey, I overhired. It's much easier to blame it on AI. But I think we are going to see some AI-based job losses. And I think it's increasingly hard for kids coming out of colleges and universities to find their first job.
Yeah.
It's still not impossible, but it's harder. So I think there is going to be more of a backlash against it. And, you know, the NIMBYism with data centers is part of that. So I'm anticipating a bit of that, which is going to be uncomfortable, but, you know, it's that always happens with new technologies. You know, people thought that if you rode on a train above the speed of 30 miles an hour, you would melt when trains first came out. So, you know, sometimes it's not always well-informed.
We've talked a bit with other people about the hype cycle, the Gartner hype cycle, and, you know, you get this big peak of, you know, everyone sort of thinking of this trough, and then it suddenly comes in. Where would you sort of put AI? And I know I'm asking you to do it very kind of broad, but have we reached that sort of peak of expectations at the moment, and do we need to become very disappointed with it for it then to become part of our everyday life? Where do you think it is on that cycle?
Honestly, that's unclear. You know, there's just so much demand for AI capabilities. You know, you're even seeing weird, strange bedfellows now with Anthropic and Elon Musk working together. Just because Anthropic desperately needed compute power and Elon had it and wasn't using it. So, yeah, I at the moment, what I see is a sustained build out for the next 3 to 5 years minimum.
Wow.
And people just buying up everything they can get. Now, the only thing that might break that is, you know, a debt crisis, because a lot of this is being funded. But revenues are coming up now. You see Anthropic actually making money for the first time. And part of that is we're moving from an all-you-can-eat pricing structure to, you know, pay-as-you-go for tokens. Yeah. And that shift, I think, is going to make these companies pretty profitable and enable them to keep that investment cycle going. So we'll see. But at the moment, it looks like we're on a sustained build out for quite some time.
My final question, Steve, is just on that, because we've talked at length about how these businesses are going to make enough money to cover the billions of investment dollars being spent in them. How do these companies, and can these companies, get to a place where they can justify the amount of capital being invested into them?
Some of it is, I think, they feel they have no choice but to invest because their competitors are investing. And so it's a, you know, mine's bigger than yours thing. but they also, they see this sustained demand. You know, we don't have robots really in our lives yet. But if you put a robot into every home in the world, you know, we're heading towards a world, and these are not my projections, but others, of between 3 and 10 billion robots by 2040. You know, they all need brains. They all need to be connected to the cloud. They all need AI. They all need training. And we're not even layering that into the demand at the moment. So all these companies are making a bet on there is demand and there that people will be paying for this stuff. You know, even if you buy a $30,000 robot and have it live, you know, for 4 years before you decide you want a new one, which is very Blade Runner-esque for your life cycle for an Android, that pencils out at about 80 cents an hour that they will work for. So, you know, it's going to be quite attractive and there's going to be a lot of them. And I think people will be willing to pay for that. And so it feels like the early stages of the internet where we hadn't quite figured out how it was going to get monetized. But that's coming. You know, you see advertising models coming. There will be many other ways that people end up paying for this. I think when we go to the agentic model, you're essentially buying a digital employee that people are going to be willing to pay for those. So I think it'll work out, but we will see. I'm not really focused on the financial side of it, more on the use cases. And the use cases are definitely there. People are going to want this stuff and lots of it.
One more thing, a company or an individual, because there's plenty of them that, you know, is maybe under the radar or worth people kind of looking at. We all kind of know the big companies, but is there kind of anyone out there or any company that's kind of bubbling up? Like, who should we keep our eye on?
The one I'm watching is called Figure. That's what I have to say it in an American accent when I'm here. The people can't understand me. When I say Figure, they're like, what? Figure. What? Oh, Figure. Oh. So Figure is the one to watch. They're the one with the robot that was doing that, working on the packaging line.
Right.
They are way ahead of anybody else in terms of the sophistication and capabilities of the models. It used to be you would give a robot a verbal instruction and it could execute on that instruction over about a 5 second period, right? Pick that glass up and put it over there. Then it moved to from seconds to minutes. That one command to do, you know, hours now working on a production line. I think by the end of this year, we'll be measuring that in days, and then next year in months. So, you know, you'll be able to say, hey, keep the house tidy, and the robot will just live in your house and keep it tidy. So Figure is the one that is pioneering that space. And I think they're going to be very interesting to watch. In some ways, they'd make beautiful robots as well. In some ways, they look like the Apple of the robot world. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, if Apple was to buy them, I wouldn't be shocked. But, you know, we'll see.
American company.
American company. They just turned 4 years old. They are now valued at $39 billion and doing another raise. I suspect that they will pass the $100 billion mark at that point. And yeah, they're very interesting.
Wow, amazing. Steve, look, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Yeah,
Steve Brown, that was fun.
He was really good. I was scribbling notes on my physical piece of paper without my AI note taker there. Embrace 21st century thinking. I quite like that.
Good. And he's brought me into a vision of robots in the house now.
Figure. Yeah.
Shame we can't invest in Figure, isn't it?
You're quite anti-robots. And now, because Steve Brown's come on and talked about them, you seem to be into them.
Don't forget, rewind the tape back to when we talked about them ages ago. I said if they could do the hoovering for me, then I'm in.
And he nailed that all day.
Also, made an interesting point about how these massive tech giants, they might not make their money back through advertising or whatever, but actually by being the brains behind the robotic future that's coming. That's something we never really... It's an interesting way of thinking about actually how they're going to make some of this huge investment back in that, you know, if like everyone in the world has an iPhone or a smartphone... If everyone in the world has a couple of robots in the house.
And that's where these valuations are at. They're at the sort of the long-term future, not what's going to happen next week. 3 to 10 billion robots by 2040 is what he was saying. And again, I think he makes this point, which I loved, which is we make all the time. When he was talking about agents, he's like agents in partnership with humans. Pair people with agents to amplify what you're doing. It's not binary. It's not one or the other. If you think we're heading for some... AI apocalypse where just the robots take over and we're all jobless, penniless and living under with the rats. It's not happening, unfortunately.
And on that cheery note...
Stay curious, everyone!
We'll say thank you so much to Steve and, of course, to you for listening to the show today. If you'd like to hear more, don't forget to subscribe, rate us, review and check us out on Substack, all that malarkey, really. We will be back on Friday with another episode, but for now, a huge thank you to Team AI, Haven't a Clue, Molly, David and Alex... And we'll be back on Friday. Until then, James.
Stay curious, please.